Okay, so we are holding on Ayin Ches Amud Beis by the two dots near the bottom, 12 lines from the bottom, 10 lines, rather, from the bottom. Okay, we learned earlier that we said in the Mishnah there's various shiurim of things. We're still in the middle of discussing the various shiurim of things that if a person carries them on Shabbos and Chayev, we mentioned about paper. That if we mentioned about blank paper, that if it's enough to write a kesher moichin, this receipt that tax collectors or toll collectors use that we talked about this morning, then a person is chayev. We also mentioned in that connection, we mentioned a braisa where if a person carries out on Shabbos a shtar parua, a shtar that was already paid off. So now we're going to talk about that point and discuss about a shtar. When is a person chayev for carrying it on Shabbos and when not? If a person carries out a shtar choiv on Shabbos, ad shalai proi chayev, if it's before he paid off the shtar, then he's chayev, because then the shtar has an importance. Now, the Gemara is going to actually give, we're going to go through a few different ways of explaining the braisa, but first we'll just explain it in the most simple sense, that it's talking about before it was paid off, so therefore it has importance, because you use it in order to collect the debt. Mishaproi potter, after it was paid back, then he's potter from carrying it off. Then he's potter for carrying it on Shabbos. Rabbi Yehuda, I'm going to ask Mishaproi chayev. Rabbi Yehuda would say even after he paid it off, he's chayev, but finish it tzorich loy because he still needs it. So we have to figure out what do we mean by he needs it. My benai, what is the underlying machloikis between them? So just like we had this morning, we had a similar thing involving a kesher shom moistin, where once you showed it to the toll collector, then the Tanakama of the Braisa said at that point you potter for carrying it on Shabbos because you have no more need for it. And then we said that Rabbi Yehuda said you chayev because you still need it. And we went through, we had three different explanations of why exactly he would need it. So similarly over here, we have a few different explanations of what it means that he still needs the shtar chayev after it's paid off. So that we're going to be going through a little bit of something involving dinei mamonos over here. So Amar Rabbi Yosef. So Rabbi Yosef says the underlying machlokas is also lahashes shtar parua ikabenayu. The argument between the Tanakama and Rabbi Yehuda is is the malve allowed to keep a shtar that was already paid back? So in this case, in other words, we're talking about the malve still has the malve still has the shtar parua, which was paid off. Or is he in fact allowed to keep it or not? So, Rabbonin Sabri also lashes shtar parua. The Rabbonin hold that you're not in fact allowed to keep around such a shtar, because Rashi quotes from a Gemara elsewhere, a pasuk in Iyav uses the expression, al tashkin ba'yalecha avla, you should not allow that in your tent, meaning in your dwelling, there should be any injustice. And if you keep a shtar parua, that's going to cause injustice, because what's going to happen is the guy already paid off the debt. You, meanwhile, have the shtar with you. At some later point, you might take out the shtar, either accidentally or on purpose, and claim the debt again. Therefore, the Tanakhama says you're not allowed to keep that shtar. So therefore, the shtar is worthless, because you're not really supposed to be keeping it. You're not even going to keep it in order to use as a bottle stopper. The loiva is also, Rashi points out, the loiva is not going to keep the shtar either, even though, of course, he has the right to keep the shtar. He's not going to use it to his detriment, but still, he's not going to want to keep it, because what if one day he loses it, and then it winds up in the hands of the malva, and the malva is going to use it to collect from him again. So therefore, as soon as the shtar is paid off, then you're going to rip it up or burn it or what have you, and therefore, so the Tanakhama would say, therefore, the shtar has no use, therefore, you're not chayev for carrying it on Shabbos. But Rabbi Yehuda tava mutar lahashis shtar parua. Meanwhile, Rabbi Yehuda holds you are allowed to keep a shtar parua. So you could still use it. You could still use it as a bottle stopper. Now, normally, of course, when the loan is paid off, then usually the malver will give the shtar back to the loiva. So here, either we're talking about the loiva still has it, and again, he could use it as a bottle stopper, and Rabbi Yehuda figures the loiva is not going to be concerned about that possibility, that it might get lost and the malva is going to find it, etc. Or we're talking about that the malva has it, but let's say, for example, you could have, conceivably, imagine when the loiva comes to pay, usually at that point the malva is supposed to give him the shtar so that he can rip it up or burn it or whatever. But conceivably it might have, but the malva doesn't happen to have the shtar on hand. He has it in his, imagine the loiva comes to the malva, in the street, for example, and pays him off his loan. And the malva, meanwhile, has the shtar closed back home. So in this case, you could have, let's say, the loiva trusts the malva that when he next gets home, he's going to rip it up. So the Tanakhama would say the malva is not allowed to keep the shtar anymore. As soon as he gets home, he has to rip it up. And Rabbi Yehuda would hold he doesn't necessarily have to, so therefore the shtar has a certain chashivus. According to the Tanakhama, Rashi explains, even the fact that maybe he's keeping it in order to return to the loiva doesn't really have an importance, because the loiva is also going to rip it up as soon as he gets it, because he doesn't want to lose it. Rabbi Yehuda says, so not Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yosef says that that's the underlying machlokes over here. Abaya Omar, second answer, Abaya says, Bikule Alma also lahashis shtar parua. No, everybody might agree that both the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yehuda might agree that the malva is not allowed to keep the shtar once it's paid off. Here we're dealing with a machloikas like this. If the loiva admits that he wrote the shtar, and normally the loiva himself is the one who writes the shtar, or he hires a sofer to write it for him, whatever. If he admits that he wrote that shtar, sorich lekaimoi, he still has to validate it. Now, in most places in Shas where we have this expression moide b'shtar shekosvei sorich lekaimoi, usually what that means is that the usual meaning of it is that even if the loiva admits that he writes the shtar, that he wrote the shtar, nevertheless, in order for the malva to be able to collect with it, that's not enough, because the loiva could say, yes, I wrote the shtar, yes, I borrowed the money, so therefore it's not a forged shtar or something, but I paid it back. And we would say, apesha also, who apesha hits it. How do we know that's a valid shtar? Only based on the loiva saying so. So therefore, usually we would say, when we say the expression, usually what that means, and Rashi himself explains in a number of other places in Shas, that it usually means the malva is now responsible to go and get a kiyum shoris done in order to be able to collect with this document. A kiyum shtoris means basically that you have the signatures of the edim validated to show that they're not forged. The Rambam summarizes based on the relevant Gemara. So you have five different ways of doing that. You can have the edim themselves can come to Beis Din and testify that these are their signatures. You can have other people come and testify in Beis Din that they recognize these signatures. You can have Beis Din can have on file a signature of these edim, whatever. You have a bunch of different ways that you can be Mekayim, that you can be Mekayim Ashtar. So the Machloikas over here would be, Abaya says, is that in fact the case? Over here, actually, Rashi learns differently. Rashi explains Moide B'Shtar Shekosvei Tzorech L'Kaimoi a little differently. Tzorech L'Kaimoi means that he has to personally say, I did not pay back the loan in this shtar. And otherwise, without that, the malva is not going to be able to collect. Because again, what makes it in the first place, what gives us some kind of reassurance that it's a valid shtar in the first place, is the fact that the loiva claim that the loiva agrees it's a valid shtar. Otherwise, without that, without the shtar, without the loiva admitting, and without the malva having yet done a kiyum, having the signatures of the edim validated by Beis Din, then the shtar is worthless to collect with, because the loiva could always claim that it was forged or something. So over here, Rashi explains the expression that sorich l'kaimoi means the loiva himself would have to admit that he didn't pay it back. The Pnei Yeshua talks about why Taka Rashi explains the expression differently here than in the rest of Shas, and he says because since it's further on, the Gemara is going to give an explanation that we're talking about that it depends whether he paid back or whether or not. The Gemara is going to give one example. The Gemara is going to give one of the answers over here is going to be that Ad Shaloi Proi and Misha Poroi, which we said in the expression in the Braisa, before he paid or after he paid, the Gemara is going to bring one of the explanations that it really means before he says he paid versus after he says he paid, and therefore Rashi prefers to understand the statement of Abaya in the same way. That we're talking about whether he himself admits that he paid it or admits that he didn't pay it or not. Whatever the case, anyway, so Abaye says that's the underlying machlokes over here. Tanakama sava moedi b'shtar shekotz v'tzorach l'kaimoi. The Tanakama therefore will hold that even though the loiver admits that he wrote the shtar, he still needs to be mekayim it. He still has to also admit that he didn't pay off the debt. Otherwise, if he claims that he paid it, then the malveh is not going to be able to collect with it unless he brings aid in to that effect. Rishonim points out. Rishonim point out, okay, in that case then, so why don't we say that, okay, he's going to find Aiden. Okay, we're talking about, let's say he tried to be Mekayim it, and he wasn't able to, or maybe even Tosfos talks about, he said, you know what, I give up, I don't have any Aiden, I don't have any Raya, it purely depends on what the loiver does, so therefore the bottom line is that, now at this point, he can't keep that shtar anymore because, again, you're not allowed to keep a shtar perua by saying everybody agrees with that. So the question, so according to the Tanakama, therefore, once it gets to the point where he's not going to be mekayim it, where he's not going to be able to mekayim it, let's say, for example, the Edom who signed it died and he knows that there's nobody around who knows what their signatures were, whatever. So then in that case, he's not allowed to keep the shtar anymore. Therefore, again, it has no use. And therefore, if he carries it on Shabbos, then he's potter. As opposed to, meanwhile, Rabbi Yehuda holds, you don't need that. Even once the loiver admits that he wrote it, even if he claims that he paid it off, nevertheless, the malva can still collect with it. Therefore, he needs the shtar. Therefore, the shtar has a use. Therefore, if he carries it on Shabbos, he's chayav. So that's the second way.
We're not worried about a kanunya. We're not worried that he'll make up the with the malva, this way he can collect from the menachar, from the.
There could be such a scenario, and when there is a possibility of making a knunia, that's a good point. When there is a possibility of making a knunia, then in fact you wouldn't be able to keep a shtar. Here we're talking about where there's no such thing. For example, there are no nechos and mishabodim involved. Okay, the point is that so far then Abaye would say that that's what we're arguing about. So everybody would agree that if the shtar is paid off, you're not allowed to keep it. The question is, are you able to collect with the shtar on the basis when the fact that the loiver admits that he wrote it, even though he claims he paid it back. So the Tanakama says that's enough to break the nambonus of the shtar, and the Rehoda says it's not. So Abaye says, "Umai ad shalai proy umisha proy." So in that case, then what does the braisa mean when it uses the expression before he paid it back or after he paid it back? I mean, if he paid it back, there's nothing to talk about. So what it means is ad shayomer haloiva paraisi v'loi paraisi. What it really means is when the loiva says, "I paid" or "I didn't pay." In other words, the words in the braisa ad shalai proy don't mean before he actually paid it, but it means before he claimed that he paid it, or after he claimed that he paid it. So that would be the machlokas. So after he claimed that he paid it, then the Tanakama would say, okay, that's it. There's nothing more you can do with it. And Rabbi Yehuda would say that meanwhile, there still is something you can do with it. You can still collect with it. Tosfos points out that, Tosfos points out the question. I mean, so then what good is the shtar doing anyway? If the loiver admits that he didn't pay off the debt, then you don't need the shtar. You anyway have the loiver's admission. And the pashtus we're talking about that he did that admission in front of Edim, which that itself, you bring Edim over there and you tell them that they're the Edei Hodah, then you can collect with that. And if not, if the loiver's going to say, I already paid back, then the shtar is worthless anyway. Okay, Tosfos says that at least the shtar helps to remind the loiver that he borrowed in the first place. At least this way he can't deny that he borrowed in the first place. All he can do is claim that he paid back. It might also help, but this way he's afraid to deny it because what's he going to do? He's going to claim that it's forged, and that could be disproved. It could be shown that it's a genuine shtar, and then he's shown to be a liar. And if he's going to claim that he paid back, okay, people are still going to be talking, look at this guy, he's getting away, he's making a claim like that. We all know it's not true. We all know it's fake news because, if he paid off the Shtar, then why is it still by the Malveh? So therefore, there is something good to be gained by the Malveh having that Shtar. So even if, again, as long as the Loiva doesn't actually say Paraisi, then the Tanakhama would say the Malveh is still entitled to keep the Shtar. As far as your point about Knunya, the Ritzvah mentions over here that point. He says that in order to collect from the Chosim or Shabbatim, you're going to need an actual Kiyum. It's not going to be enough for the Loiva to say, I didn't pay back, because like you said, Ellie, there could be a Knunya over here. They could be trying to play tricks over here in order to get the Chosim or Shabbatim out from the Lakufa. Okay. Fine. So that's Abaye's explanation of what the Braitha means. So again, we had Rabbi Yosef's explanation so far that the question was whether Bechlal you're allowed to keep a shtar that was paid off. The Tanakhama says no, Rabbi Yehuda says yes. You have Abaye's explanation that for sure you can't keep such a shtar, but the question is, when the Loiva admits that he wrote the shtar, do we actually need a kiyum? Do we need him to verbally admit that he didn't yet pay it back in order for the Malva to collect or not? Rabba gives a third explanation. Everybody would agree that even if the loiva admits that he wrote the shtar and that it's a genuine shtar, you still need a kiyum, which again, usually a kiyum would mean to validate the signatures. And again, in this case, Rashi explains a little bit differently, that maybe it means the loiva himself admitting that he didn't pay it, whatever it is. So there's no machlokas on that. The argument between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yehuda would be the question, do we write a shoiva? A shoiva is a receipt. Now, you have two possibilities. When you pay off a loan, either the Malva gives back the shtar chayv, or the Malva is able to hold on to the shtar chayv and he writes a receipt for the loiva. And you actually have a machlokas on that in Baba Basra and in some other places, whether that's the case. In other words, basically the question in that case is, If we say ein koisvin shover, then what it means is, in the scenario that we had before, let's say, where the loiva comes to pay off the malva, and the malva says, I don't have the shtar right now, if we say ein koisvin shover, then what it means is, the loiva has the right to say, okay, in that case, I'm not going to pay you back yet, I'm going to wait until you can get the shtar and bring it to me, because otherwise I'm afraid that you might end up accidentally or on purpose trying to collect the same shtar again, which you're not allowed to do. That would be ein koisvin shover. As opposed to, if we say koisvin shover, would mean the malva has the right to tell the loiva, you pay me back right now. What's going to happen about that? I might try to use the shtar again. I'll write you a receipt. You're going to be responsible to keep that receipt and make sure, as Gemara expresses it in other places, you're going to have to make sure that mice don't eat up that receipt. And that way, if it should ever happen that you're worried that I might take out the shtar chayv and try to use it against you again, then you'll pull out your receipt, and the receipt will show that you paid me back already, and therefore you won't have to pay again. So it's a machlokas in a couple of places in Shas whether we say koisvin shover. So whether we can force the loiva to pay back when the shtar chayv is not available. Now you have two different.
Yeah,
The halacha, if I remember correctly, is koisvin shover, that the malva can require the loiva to pay back. I'm not quite sure about that though. I'd have to see. But anyway, now Rashi. Now there's two different gersois over here actually. There's actually the Gersa we have in front of us in the Gemara, let's deal with that first, because Rashi prefers that Gersa, and then we'll talk about the other Gersa. Tanakhama sava koisvin shover. The Tanakhama is going to hold that you write a shover. So therefore, in other words, the malva can require the loiva to pay back even though the shtar chayv is not available right now. The halacha is that a person comes to pay back, the malva says, I lost the shtar, the loiva is not able to say, I'm not going to pay you back until you give me my shtar. He has to pay him, the guy will write him out a shover, and what now the, all it is. And Shulchan Aruch mentions that the loiver is able to make what's called a cherem stam. He's able to make Beis Din declare, he's able to tell Beis Din declare a cherem generically against anybody who would do such a thing, who would keep a shar and falsely claim that it was lost. But then you have a case where he claims that I know for sure he has the shtar, then you make him alva, swear hesed. But anyway, the halacha is that kosev and shover.
So
anyway, so the kind of...
So a shover is accepted in this case?
Yeah. So, well, so in general, in other words, in a typical case where a malva is coming to the loiva and saying, "New, pay up what you owe me," and the loiva says, "Okay, I'm ready to pay you as soon as you have your shtar available," and the malva says, "Let's say I don't have the shtar anymore, I lost it." If we say ein kosev and shover, then it would mean the loiver has the right to say, "I'm sorry, I'm not paying you back. I'm not expected to hold on to a shtar indefinitely. You lost your shtar. Tough luck. I'm not paying back unless you have a shtar." Whereas if we say kosev and shover, then the malva has the right to say, "I'm sorry. You pay back your debt. I will write you a shover, and it's your responsibility from now on to hold on to that shover." Again, you have the loiver can make a cherem stam, or in certain cases he can make the loiver, he can make the malva swear a shvuah hesed, but whatever. The point is that he still has to pay back, and he's expected to get a shover. So the Tanakh Kama over here would hold that kosev and shover. You do write a shover. Therefore, in other words, so the Tanakh Kama says, look, what happens once the shtar is paid off? If the malva carries that shtar out on Shabbos, it's a useless shtar. He doesn't need it. He doesn't need it anymore because he can't use it again. He can't use it again. There is a shover. There is a shover out there. So he's not able to keep it anymore. He's not allowed to use it as a bottle stopper. It's useless to him at that point. He can't use it anymore to collect again. So he doesn't need the shtar anymore. At that point, all he needs really is he writes a shover instead. And therefore, he doesn't need the shtar to hold on to it in order to return it to the loiver, because if we say kosev and shover, he doesn't have to return it. He gives a shover instead, and now he doesn't need that shtar anymore. And on the other hand, again, like as Rashi says, as he said before, the loiver is not going to want to keep it either, because he wants to rip it up as soon as possible. So Tosfos learns a little bit differently. Tosfos says that actually, if he didn't give him the shover yet, then of course he still needs the shtar chayv. We're talking about after he gave him the shover. Whatever, that's the kind of Kama hold that once he gave him the shover, then the receipt, then at that point he doesn't need the shtar chayv anymore, therefore it's useless and carrying it on Shabbos is not relevant. But Rabbi Yehuda Saba, in kosev and shover, Rabbi Yehuda would hold you don't write a shover. You can't do that. The loiver is entitled to not pay off the debt until the malva gives him the shtar. Therefore, the malva, of course, has to keep the shtar. So he needs to return it to the loiver. So now, therefore, if he carries it out on Shabbos, then he's going to be chayav. Now, Rashi brings a different girsa the other way around. The Tanakh Kama would say ein kosev and shover, and Rabbi Yehuda would say kosev and shover. Meaning, in other words, Rashi explains, according to that girsa, it would go like this. The Tanakh Kama says, you don't write a shover, so you have to return him the shtar, therefore you're not allowed to keep it, and therefore it has no use. Rabbi Yehuda would hold kosev and shover, and once you write a shover, then the malva is able to keep it in order to use it as a bottle stopper. Rashi says, I don't like that explanation, though. I don't like that gusa for a couple of reasons. Number one, even if you're going to write a shover, the halacha is you're not allowed to keep a shtar perua, especially because what if the other guy loses his shover in the end? And anyway, we also find in the Gemara in Baba Basra that talks about these dinim where Rabbi Yehuda says you don't write a shover. So how can we say over here Rabbi Yehuda is the one who holds that you do write a shover? So therefore, that's why Rashi prefers the gusa that we mentioned before, which is in fact how we have it printed in the Gemara. Usually, by the way, what happened is, because in most places in Shas, when Rashi said, I like this Girsa, usually what happened was, afterwards, when people are copying out new copies of the Gemara in Kisvei Yad for themselves, so naturally they followed the Girsa that Rashi preferred. And therefore, eventually, when it came to printing, then usually that was the Girsa that made it into the printed Gemara. Okay. So anyway, according to Rabba's explanation, The question is, basically, when we're dealing with this matter of, is there a matter of shoiver here or not, and therefore, is the malva going to be able to keep that shtar or not? Is it that you do have to write a shoiver, therefore, once the shoiver was written, then the malva has no more need for the shtar, because a shoiver was already written, and he's not even going to return it to the loiva to use as a bottle stopper, because the loiva doesn't want it as a bottle stopper. He wants to destroy it as soon as possible in case it gets lost, and the malva finds it, etc. And Rabbi Huda would say, in kos ben shover, and therefore the malva does in fact have to return the shtar chov to the loiva, and therefore it has an importance to him until he actually returns it, because without that he's not entitled to get his money back. Okay. So that's explanation number three. Rav Ashi gives a fourth answer. Never mind all of that. The reason why Rav Yehuda would say you're chayev for carrying a shtar chov on Shabbos, we're not talking about like we were according to the first three explanations, we're talking about the malva carrying out the shtar on Shabbos. And we're asking, is the malva allowed to have that shtar? Does the malva have any use for that shtar, etc.? Here, Rav Ashi flips that around and says, we're actually talking about the loiva carrying out the shtar. So Rav Yehuda would say that the reason why the loiva would keep the shtar, because he wants to use it in order to show to another creditor of his. If he has to borrow money from somebody else, he wants to show that he has a good credit rating. He will say, just like we said before with the moiches, that he will keep around old shtarei chov of his in order to be able to show prospective lenders that, look, I'm an honest person, I pay off my debt. So therefore, Sir Rabbi Huda will say that therefore he has a need for that, and therefore he will keep it for that purpose. So in other words, it comes out according to Rav Ashi, what the Braisa means is like this: if he carries out a shtar chov before it was paid off, meaning if the malva has it, then he's chayev because the malva obviously has a need for the shtar. Once it was paid off and it was given to the loiva, then the loiva, the Tanakhama says, is potter for carrying it because he doesn't need it anymore because it was already paid off. And Rav Ashi and Rabbi Huda would say he's chayev, because the loiva himself wants to keep it around to show that he has a good credit rating. Okay, so those are four different ways of understanding the machlokas of the Chachamim and Rabbi Huda. Okay. Next.
The one parak Rambam is speaking a little here about the Mekayim Ashtar, and a guy, the witness is die here, he has a star, you could show, oh, you see, his signature matches my document, so here's a good way to even kind of, I mean, a way of thinking that this could be good for someone who wants to be able to prove that his signatures are good signatures and they're recognizable because the regular Adam on his document died. Right, it died, yeah. So is it, yes, I mean, but you live this on Peric.
I guess that's a good point, and it is true that is one of the five ways of being Mekayim Ashtar, using existing signatures from those edim. However, first of all, I don't think in that case necessarily the loiva is going to keep the shtar. In that case, he would deposit it in Beis Din, so Beis Din has that signature on file. Otherwise, what good would it do for a kiyum? If he uses this old shtar for a kiyum, then somebody else might say, okay, you forged the old shtar and you forged a new one.
Nowadays you put paid, and this way you know it right across the whole thing. It's paid, so it's good for signatures, but it shows pay, so no one's going to come back and say anything, you know.
Right, I understand. I hear what you're saying, but still, I mean, if he himself just for Kiyum, I don't know that would necessarily work anyway. But perhaps if he would send it off to Beis Din in order that Beis Din can keep it on file in that case. But okay, that's a valid point, maybe. All right.
Okay.
Next, we said in the Mishnah, Ur Kedei Lasef Kola, we said that the shear of carrying out a skin or leather on Shabbos is the amount to make for a casing for a Kamea. So, Bominei Rava Merav Nachman. So Rava started by asking Rav Nachman the question, Hamoisi Ur Shabahema Bakama. If a person carries out an animal skin on Shabbos, what's the amount that he would have, what's the amount that if he carries his chayim? Omalei, Rav Nachman tells him, Kedetam, like we said in the Mishnah, or Kedelasis Kamea. As we said in the Mishnah, the amount of leather that it would take to write a Kamea. So the Pashtus Rava is not asking the question because he didn't know the Mishnah. The Pashtus Rava is asking the question just as an introduction to the following questions that he's going to ask. Then Rava asked another question. What about if a person tans leather on Shabbos, which, as we learned in the previous credit, is one of the 39 malachas, Bikama? What is the shear that he has to, what's the minimum shear of tanning that he has to do in order to be chayav achashas? Rav Nachman tells him there's no difference. The amount would also be the same amount if you tanned enough leather to be, if you tanned enough leather to be able to make a kameya, then you chayav achashas. Then Rava asked, La'abjoy b'tama, what about if a person takes out skin which was not yet tanned, and he's carrying it out in order, he hasn't yet tanned it, but he plans to tan it, then what would the shear be? So far, in other words, we had when it was already to a certain extent tanned, and then you use it for a casing for a kameya, as we're going to say later on in the Gemara, you have three stages in tanning leather. So here we're talking about that you're using it for a kameya is where the first stage has, where the first stage has been, or the second stage actually has been done, and then that would be when it's enough to make a kameya. Then he asked him about tanning it, and then he asked him, what if it's not tanned yet, or it's not tanned to that second stage? What would be the shield to carry that if he carries it on Shabbos he's chayav? Reb Nachman tells him again, there's no difference. In all cases, it's the same thing. It's the amount that you would use to write a case, to make a casing for a kameya. So the question is, so where do you get that concept that there should be a difference, that there shouldn't be a difference, that it should be the same thing whether the leather has been tanned yet or not? So he said, Reb Nachman tells him, because it's not. As we learn in a Mishnah later on in Armasechta, Hamalabin, if a person when a person bleaches wool or whatever, which we said was one of the 39 malachas, v'hamenafes, or he combs it in order to get all the fibers to line up straight, v'hatseveya, or he dyes it, v'hatoyve, or he spins it. So those are four of the 39 malachas that we learned in the previous parak. All of them have the same shear. Shi'urei kimloi roichav asitch kofel, the shear that would be higher for any of those four malachas is if he did enough of the material that you could make from it a roichav asit kofel. So roichav asit means the distance between the index finger and the thumb when you stretch them apart as far as possible. Then maloy roichav asit kofel would be double that, would be the amount from the end of the little finger to the thumb when you stretch it out, which is about twice the distance from the index finger to the thumb. So that's called Maloy Roichav Asit Kofel. Okay, the Rambam actually has a bit of a different definition of Maloy Roichav Asit Kofel. We'll talk about it when we get to these details on the 13th Perek, Bez Hashem. Anyway, so that's the Mishnah says that, and the Mishnah continues, V'ha'orig Shnei Chutin, when it comes to the actual weaving, when a person weaves, we said in the Mishnah in the previous Perek, that if a person weaves two rows of Erev in the cloth, then he's chayav chatas. And that is, so how much is that? It's shura. Kimloidoich habasit kofel is the amount, or kofel actually is in parenthesis over here because not necessarily should it be in the Gemara. The width of the distance between the thumb and the index finger. Not between the thumb and the index finger, actually. Rashi says between the Eskva and the Amma, which is the second and third fingers, rather. So that would be the amount. If a person weaves that amount one way and then the other, then he's Chayav Chatas. Actually, the first one also, Rashi says, Kedei Hefesh Eskva and Amma, so I said it wrong. The Rambam, I think, defines it as the distance from the thumb to the index finger. Rashi defines a sit as the distance from the index finger to the middle finger, and then the Loyloch of a sit kofel would be double that. Anyway, the point is, Alma, so Rav Nachman says, "Kivin b'latviyakoy." So what do we see from that? Even though with the various stages that we mentioned over here, as far as bleaching it or combing it or dyeing it, you haven't yet spun it into thread, but you're going to. Therefore, shi'ura ketavoy. Therefore, you give it the same shear as the actual spinning. So just like for actual spinning, a person is chayav only if they spin a roich of a sit kofel twice the distance from the index finger to the middle finger. So therefore, the same thing when it comes to bleaching it, and the same thing when it comes to combing it out, and the same thing when it comes to dyeing it. Hachanami. So the same thing over here. When it comes to your question, so Rava's question about the leather, the same thing. Kivin del abdekoi, since you're going to be tanning it, shear it, come over, so you treat it as far as the shear, has the same shear as if it was already tanned, as if it was already made into leather, and therefore it would be the same amount, the amount for the casing for the kameya. Okay. Choseph actually points out that, I mean, the Gemara could have said that in the end you weave it, but the answer is not all thread that spun ends up being woven. Some thread that you spin, you end up using for other purposes. You end up using it for sewing or whatever. But you definitely once you're bleaching and combing and dyeing the wool, you're generally speaking going to be making thread out of it, and therefore then you're going to be spinning thread out of it, and therefore the Gemara mentions that point. Okay, fine. Then Rava asks, the shaloi la'abge b'kama, what about if you have leather that you're not planning to tan, so you're just planning to leave it as raw leather, then what would be the shear? Amalei lo'shan, still Rav Nachman tells him there's no difference. Again, it would be the amount that would be a casing for a kameya. So now Rava has some questions. The lo'shani ben ma'ubad l'sha'eni ma'ubad. Are you telling me then that there's no difference between leather that was tanned and leather that was not tanned? And either way, you're saying that whether you're planning to tan it or whether it's not, you're always going to say it has the same shear. So Rava says to Rav Nachman, I have a contradiction. A braisa says like this, so leaving aside leather a minute, let's talk about a different case involving a different one of the malachas. A braisa says, Hamotzi samonin shruyin, if a person carries out on Shabbos dye stuff that were already soaked in water. Now, later on in the next perek, we're going to talk about materials that can be used for dye stuff that were not yet made into dye. We're going to quote it in another line in the Gemara. There are different kinds of peels or things like that that are used to make dye. But the Braisa says, if a person carries out dye that's already made, that's already been mixed with water and is ready to dye with, then of course in his chai of chasas, if it was kedelus boya bahen dugma le'ira, then it would be if it's enough dye that you could dye for a sample which is the same size as an ira. So a sample, Rashi explains, let's say for example, a dyer, a person who dyes cloth, a dyer who dyes material or cloth or whatever professionally for a living. So he will have to have samples on hand, like when you go to a paint store, you know, and they have samples of the different colors so you can pick the color you want. The same thing, a dyer will have on hand little pieces of cloth that he uses as samples so a person can pick, I want this color or that color. That's called dugma. And then Rashi explains, le'ira is another way of defining the same amount. An ira is like this. We talked about in the previous perek, when we talked about the malachas involving weaving, what we said is what happens is you have the loom set up, you have the shefty threads that are wound around from one roller to the other, from the kovid elyon to the kovid apachron. You have them passing through the loops over there in the frames that you're gonna raise and lower the frames to be able to weave the cloth. As you're raising and lowering the frames, each time you take the eight of thread and you throw it between the two sets of shefty threads, and that's how you make another row of the cloth. And then you raise the other frame and lower the first one, and then you throw it back and forth. You're throwing the eight of back and forth. The Erev is wrapped up inside something called in English a shuttle, and that's where we get the word in English shuttle, like when we have a shuttle flight or a shuttle train or whatever, because it goes back and forth the way the shuttle does in the weaving. Rashi calls it a kone. It's a reed. It's a hollow piece of bamboo or something that you have the thread wrapped up inside it. What you want to do is, You don't want all the thread to come out every time you're throwing it back and forth. So what you do is you wind up the thread, you roll up the thread on a spool inside the shuttle. Then what you do is you cover up, you stuff the open end of the shuttle with a little piece of cotton or something, and then you make a small hole in that for the thread to be able to come out through that. So that way the thread just comes out through that hole and it doesn't go completely off the spool and get all tangled up in the cloth that you're weaving. So that small amount of cloth that you use to stop up that shuttle is called an ira, and that is the same amount as you would use for a dogma. That's the same amount that a dyer would use as a sample to show people the colors he has available. Okay, so that's as far as the Braisa says when the dye is already made. The ilu b'samon and she'enon shurian. Now, what about when it comes to dye materials that have not yet been soaked and have not yet been boiled up to make dye? So it's none. We learn in a Mishnah in the next paragraph. Klipei agoizim, if a person takes out on Shabbos nutshells, which is, we're talking about, for example, Rashi described, you have a moist, like this, when we buy nuts in the store, they don't have this anymore because it falls off, but when nuts grow on a tree, they have a soft shell or a soft peel around them, and you can use that for dyeing. The color in it is a color that can be used for dyeing. Or klipei rimonin, or pomegranate shells, same for pomegranate peels, same thing, you can use those for dyeing. Or sisapua, which are various kinds of herbs that are used for dyeing. So all of them is kedelik vayabahan beged kotten lafisvacha. For those, you need a larger amount. Those you need, the amount of that a person would be high for carrying them on Shabbos, is where it's enough to be able to dye the small piece of cloth that goes on top of a woman's tichel. So like this, a woman covers, as we learned in the sixth parak, a woman covers her hair with a tichel or a hat or something like that, and there zvacha literally means a net, because it was made sort of like a net. It was made kind of like the snood they have nowadays that are woven in a net-like fashion. And then the style was they had a little piece of cloth on top of it for decoration. So you'd have, so when you're talking about raw dye stuff, then you need a larger amount, the amount that it would take to dye that larger piece of cloth that goes on top of the tichel. As opposed to, once the dye is already made, then it's a smaller amount, the amount that a dyer needs for a sample to show prospective customers, which is the same as the amount that you would use to close up the hole in the shuttle so you can weave. So you see that there's a difference between whether it's already made or not. So by the same logic, there should be a difference when it comes to leather, whether the leather has already been tanned or not. The answer is Ha'itmar Allah. You should know there was said about that. That Rav Nachman explained in the name of Rav Baravua, the reason why you have a larger amount for raw dye stuff, like the nutshells or whatever, than you do for already made dye, is like it's a similar svara. As we said earlier, because nobody goes to the trouble of soaking dyes and boiling up dyes or whatever in order to make the tiny amount that you would need for a dugma or for an ira. If you need a dugma or you need an era, you're going to boil up a larger amount of dye, and then you're going to use some of it for that, and you can use the rest of it for another project. So therefore, there's a difference between whether the dye is already made. But Rav Nachman is saying, when it comes to leather, it's not like that. A person might well go to the trouble of tanning a small piece of leather enough to be able to make a casing for a kameya. So therefore, it would be the same shield. Okay. Fine. The Rava asks, what about, I'll give you another example, when it comes to garden seeds, vegetable seeds. Now, we're talking about, Zer'onegina in Gemara terminology usually means seeds that are not edible. So they're things that you plant in order to grow new plants, but you don't actually eat them themselves. So the mikame dezarinu. So the din is before you planted them. Snan, we learn at the beginning of it. We learn at the end of the ninth parak. They're only dina pachas mikigregeres. That when it comes to garden seeds like that, a person is chayav if he takes out a little less than a gregeres. As you said, food is a gregeris, but here these things are not food. Therefore, he's higher for a bit of a smaller amount. Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira says he's higher for carrying out only five seeds, because according to him, five seeds is already enough to go and plant. The ilu bosa is the zarinusnan, but that's before seeds are planted, so he carries out the actual seeds themselves. But after the seeds are planted, let's say, for example, a person was taking out fertilizer, for example, to fertilize them, then it's a different amount. Tanan, we learn in another Mishnah, which is further on in our Perek. Zevel v'chol adak, if a person takes out on Shabbos manure or fine sand, which can be used for fertilizer, then the shear that he's chayav kedei lezavel bo'is kelach shel kruv, It would be if there's enough to be able to fertilize one stalk of cabbage. Divrei Rav Akiva. That's what Rav Akiva says. The Chumrem Kedela Zabo Kresha. The Chum says you don't need that large amount. It's enough if you have enough to be able to fertilize a leek, which is a smaller plant. Anyway, the point is, so again, once the plant is planted, then one by itself is considered significant. And you carry out enough fertilizer to fertilize that one plant, then already you're chayav. As opposed to, we're saying before you plant it, then you need, according to the Tanakhama, later on you need almost a tegregerus worth of seeds, according to the Yehudim and Maseir 5. So again, you see there's a difference between before they're planted and after. So why shouldn't there be a difference between before you tan leather and afterwards? And again, the answer is Ha'itmar Allah, Amar Papa. The answer is Rapapa explained about that. Now, Bapashtas, we're not talking about... Now, these questions were not necessarily that Rava is asking these questions to the Nachman anymore. Because Rapapa, for example, is one of Rava's and Abayas Talmidim. So obviously, they're not quoting him over there. So either it could be that it was an answer that was known before, but it's recorded in the Gemara in Rapapa's name, because it was known in the Beth Medrash in his name. Or it could be that this is part of the Stam of the Gemara from after the time of Rava and Rav Nachman. This could be part of the Stam of the Gemara that was composed by Ravina and Ravashi, and they're already referring to what Rapapa says. So the answer is, Ha'itman Allah, Omar Rapapa, Ha'dizriya, Ha'dalizriya. That's exactly it. Rapapa says there's a difference between whether it's planted already or not. Look, for the same reason, because nobody bothers taking out one seed in order to plant it. But therefore, you're not chayav for carrying out one seed on Shabbos according to anybody. As opposed to, again, when it comes to leather, then you could say a person would go to the trouble of tanning a little bit of it in order to use it for a covering for a command. Okay. Next, Bahare Tit. What about another example would be mud. Which we discussed on Ayin Chesem and Aleph, Dimikama Deligbele, before you mix up the mud with water to make it usable, as mud or mortar or whatever, Tanya, we learned in a Braisa, which we learned this morning, Modim Chachamim L'Rishimin, B'Moisi Shofchin L'Rishutar Adam Shashiorim B'Rivius, that the Chachamim, who disagree with Rav Shimon about the Shiorim that you need for various kinds of liquids, they agree that if he carries out dirty water into Rishutar Adam, then the shear that he's high of is a revius, the habinon ba, and when we learned it before on Ayin Chesem and Aleph, we asked the question, shoykhin l'maychol, who after all, what do you use dirty water for, such that he should be high of for a revius anyway? What's the usefulness of a revius of shoykhin? And the Amr of Yirmi, and we answered Rav Yirmi said, l'gabal behenes hatit, because you could use a revius of dirty water to mix up with clay to make mortar. So you see that you need a larger amount to be chayav in that case before he actually mixed it up. The ila baser de gabli. What happens after he mixed it up? Then Tanya, we learn in a different braisa, which we also learned then. Kis kedei lasis behen pikur. But then you need a much smaller amount, just the amount that you would put around the hole. In a vat, in a melting pot that you're using to smelt gold, which was much smaller. So again, you see, there's a difference between whether it's already made or not. When the mud is already made and mixed up, then you need a very small shear of it to be chayav. But when it's not mixed up, then you need a much larger shear. So why shouldn't it be the same thing with leather? And again, the answer is hasam nami kudam maron, as we said before. Same idea. A person is not going to bother mixing up mud just for the purpose of using around the hole in the melting pot. He's going to mix up a larger amount of hafkila and then use some of it for that and some of it for another project. But once it's made already, then he'll keep a smaller amount. Again, as opposed to leather, a person is going to go to the trouble maybe of tanning a piece of leather large enough to be able to use as a casing for a command. So again, it's no difference whether it was already tanned or not. Okay. Another question on Rav Nachman. Tashma. Let's prove from as follows. There are three stages in making leather. There were three stages actually where it's incomplete before it reaches the stage of being cloth. Eventually you have it completely tanned and it's made into parchment and then it's called cloth. But here we're listing the three stages before that. So number one, they're called Masa, V'chifa, V'dikra. And what are they as follows? Masa, K'mashmon. So Master is exactly what it sounds like. It means like it's like incomplete. It's like not really worked over like master in that sense. Deloy maliachu, deloy kamiachu, deloy ofit. Now, normally you have like this. In order to make a piece of leather into parchment that you can write on, you need three things need to be done to it. You need to first you treat it with salt. First you treat it. So what happened was, so you have the leather comes off the animal. It's still fresh. It's still moist. What you do is first you salt it, and that helps dry it out. Then you mix it. Then you soak it in a mixture of flour and water. Then you soak it in a mixture of flour and water. And then the last thing is you soak it in May Eftim, which is some, which in English it's called gallnut extract. Gallnuts are a kind of growth that grows on oak trees and certain other kind of trees. These gallnuts contain something called tannin, which is actually it's somewhat related to what you have in tea and various other things. It helps each of these things in its own way helps to do something to the leather to turn it into usable parchment. In particular, what you have is the last thing, the efsa, the mea fustin, this gallnut extract. What it makes is that now without that, you're able to write on. If you don't do that third stage, it's still smooth enough to be able to write on. But the problem is that then it's very easy to erase it, and it's not going to be noticeable that anything was erased. So as we're going to say on the days, you can't use that for sifrei Torah, tefillin, and mezuzos. You also can't use it for things like shoreis, where you need something that can't be forged. But you can use it for other purposes, as the Gemara is going to say soon. So you have those three stages. So it's like this. Master kimashmoi. Master means what it sounds like, but it's not, no processing has been done to it at all. Deloi maliach, deloi kamiach, deloi ofit. It hasn't been salted. It hasn't been treated it hasn't been soaked in the flour and water mixture, and it hasn't been treated with the gorma. So it's basically just a raw skin, pretty much. The kama shiur, right? So what's the shiur that a person should be chayev for carrying it on Shabbos? Tony of Shmuel bar Rav Yehuda, today lotsu by mishkolas tama. It would be the amount that you would need in order to wrap up a small weight made out of lead. When you have weights that a storekeeper uses to weigh out products that he's selling to the customers, you have to make sure, of course, we know in many places the Torah warns you that your weights and measures have to be 100% honest. And among other things, that means if they're made out of metal rusts away, rubs away after a while. So you need to keep, if you have metal weights, you need to keep them wrapped up so they don't get rubbed out from too much use. So therefore, you need like a leather pouch to put them in. And for that, you can use raw leather. The kama, so that would be the shiur. The kama, the Gemara asks, what's the size of the small weight we're talking about? I'm going to buy a riva de riva de pumpadissa, a quarter of a lug, a quarter of a litra of the size that they use in pumpadissa. The litra itself is called, the litra itself is called a riva because it's a quarter of some larger thing. A quarter of a litra is the smallest. What? A quarter of a litre is the smallest size weight that they used in Pumbedisa. So therefore, so that would be the amount that the Rambam describes for that. It's the weight of a shekel. It's the weight of a shekel, which is like less than an ounce. So therefore, so a piece of leather, that's the size. You can wrap such a thing in it. That would be the size of raw leather that a person is hired for carrying on Shabbos. Then the next stage is chifa, is the maliach b'loy kamiach b'loy ofit. It's called chifa when it's gone through the first stage. You salted it in order to dry it out, but you didn't yet soak it in the flour and water mixture. You didn't yet soak it in the gallnut mixture. The kama shiur, right? So what would be the shiur that a person is chayav for carrying that on Shabbos? That would be kedikan or kedei lasis kameya. That would be the stage that we're talking about in our Mishnah, where the first stage of the processing and has been done to it, then therefore it can now be used as a covering for a kameya. Then diftera, the next stage is called diftera, which actually comes from a Greek word that means a skin. That is the maliach kameyach v'loy ofit. That means that the first two things have been done. It's been treated with salt. It's been treated with flour, with a flour and water mixture. It hasn't yet been treated with a gallnut mixture. So now at this point, it's smooth enough to write on, but it's not usable enough to be able to write things that if you erase them, if you write on such a thing, it won't be noticeable. The kamashira kedei lichtiv all of us a get. Then the amount would be if it's large enough to write a get on. Now Rashi learns we're not talking about the entire get. We're actually talking about the Torah of the get, the essential parts of the get, which is like this. We have a get as nowadays is written as a long thing, and it runs 12 lines. It's written quite large. But the gufo shel get, Rashi describes, is the words that he had reyat moteres b'chol adam, and the names of the husbands and the wife, names of the husband and the wife and the edim, and the date. So Rashi explains that as we get, as the leather gets further and further processed, then the size that a person has chayav for carrying it on Shabbos becomes smaller and smaller. So when it was completely unprocessed, then it was the amount that's needed to wrap up a weight, which is the largest amount. Then you have a smaller one was to wrap up a kameya, which is smaller, and now you have to write the essential part of a get, which is even smaller than that. Tosfos doesn't go that way. Tosfos explains that actually we're talking about we're actually talking about the entire Tosfos and a bunch of other Rishonim explain that lichtiv as a get means the entire get. So it is actually larger. It is actually larger, but the point is because once you have gifted or once you've done the first two stages of it, you're not going to use it to cover a kameya anymore. Then you're only going to use it for important purposes like writing a get. Anyway, so the point is katonim yes. So the bottom line is we said when it came to the unprocessed letter, then we said kedei lasur b'mishkolis kana. We said it's enough if a person is chayav even when it's a piece. Only when it's a piece that's large enough to be able to wrap in it a small weight. But Amar Abaya River, the river, the Pumbedita, and we said Abaya says that means the quarter litra of that they use in Pumbedita, which is larger, therefore, than you have for the next stage, Chippa, which is the amount that you would use to cover a Kameya. So again, you see there's a difference with leather itself. There's a difference between the different stages of it. So what are you telling me Rav Nachman, that it's the same thing, that regardless, it's always going to be the amount you use to cover a Kameya, when the Braisa is saying no? The answer is Hasam b'bishula. The answer is that then when we're talking about Ur-Masa, we don't mean that it hasn't been processed at all. We mean that it really hasn't been processed at all. It's just been taken off the animal. It hasn't even been dried off yet. It hasn't been even been dried yet. So in other words, we have like this. You have the three stages that we're mentioning, the three stages of processing. But before you even start any of those stages, it first has to be dried up a little bit. It still has to be that you didn't just take it off the animal. So you have, once you stripped it off the animal and it dried up a bit, then you start processing it by putting leather and the flour and water mixture, etc. Here, when we say kedei lasur b'mishkolis kana, we're talking about just flesh off the animal. So therefore, it's not even usable to tan yet, because in order to tan it, you'd have to wait until it starts drying up a little bit. Therefore, it would have a larger shear. But once it's already able to be started to tan, then it would have the same shear. Then it would have the same shear as once it's already tanned. You're not going to say. Okay. So the question still is, v'hatsnan, what about though? We learn in a Mishnah in Kalim, habeged shloishal shloishal the midrash. We learned this before. We learned this in the previous parak, that when it comes to cloth, the minimum amount of makabel tumas midrash, if it's a zav, sits or stands or whatever on it, is if it's 3x3 tvachim, a staff abalaba, a staff cloth, you need 4x4 tvachim, a piece of leather, the amount is 5x5 tvachim, mafas vavavav, if it's a mat, then it needs to be 6x6 tvachim, and that is bain lamidras, bain lames. Those last three, the staff cloth, the leather, and the mat, which is made out of reeds or whatever, woven together, all of those, the shiurim 4x4 or 5x5 or 6x6, those shiurim apply equally to whether we're talking tumas midras or any other tumah, as opposed to with cloth, where as we learned earlier in the sector, when it comes to most tumas, 3x3 voice is enough, and only when it comes to midras do you need 3x3 tefachim. Anyway, but Tony Allah, and we learn in a braisa regarding that, habeged v'asakra or as far when it comes to cloth and sackcloth and leather, kashir la truma, kashir la itza, the same exact shear that would apply as far as truma, the same shear applies as far as itza, meaning that if a person carries, for example, if a person carries out a piece of leather less than 4x4 tefachim, then he's not chayav. Then he's not chayav chasas on Shabbos. So we see that you need. So we see therefore that it's actually 5x5 really. Now that's much larger than you need in order to wrap around the kameya. So what are you telling me that for leather, no matter what stage it's in, you need the amount to wrap a kameya? Except we said, okay, when it's fresh off the animal, then it's the amount that you use to wrap up a metal weight in. Either way, the Braisa seems to be saying that you need 5x5, which is much larger. The answer is hahu b'kutuvla. The answer is that's talking about a different thing. What you do sometimes with leather, what you do is you boil it in hot water. You put it in boiling hot water, and what that accomplishes is it makes the leather very hard. And now once it's very hard, then you use it, for example, now you can use it as something to put on a chair or as a tablecloth or something. So now, once it's boiled up like that, you can't do anything else with it. You're never going to be able to take that leather and turn it into parchment to write on. So that would be when you need 5x5 talking. So in other words, it comes out like this, basically. What we're saying is, depending what's done with the leather, if the leather is just fresh off the animal and nothing else was done with it, it wasn't even dried up yet, then the amount the person is hired for is if it's the amount that you can use to wrap up then it's the amount that you'd use to wrap up a small weight. Then you have once you start the processing of it, then you have when you use the salt on it. When you use the salt on it, then, let me see actually. So when it's fresh off the animal, that's when we would say that you chayev if it's large enough to wrap up a small weight. Once you started the processing of it, so then we said you have the amount, and then you have the amount to make a kameya. And then that's when Rav Nachman is saying that you chayev also, even if the leather has not actually been done to that yet, but as long as it's able to be done, where even you haven't yet applied the salt, but you could apply the salt, therefore already it has that shear. Then you have diftara, where it's been salted and floured, and now it's smooth enough to write on, and the amount is to write a get. And then you have when it was completely boiled to make it into hard leather, then you have it's 5x5 bachim, and when it was completely processed, where you also did the ester, you also did the gallnut extract that you soaked it in, then it's gonna be parchment, and that we're gonna talk about next. So now the Mishnah said klaf kedei lichtav al parsha kana. We said if a person carries out parchment on Shabbos, then the amount is higher if it's the amount that you could write on the smallest parasha in tefillin, which we said is the parasha of Shema. So then let's say, I have a contradiction. Klaf v'duchsus, if a person carries out klaf or duchsus, and I'll explain in a second what duchsus is, then the shear is kedei lichtav olav mezuzah. Then it would be if it's large enough to write a mezuzah. Now it's like this. Tosfos explains, based on Gemara's and other places, that what you have is like this. You have, when you take the skin off the animal, you can keep the skin in its full thickness and tan it and make parchment out of it, and that is called gzil. Gzil means something, means something that was not cut. Like you have at the beginning of Baba Basra, the gzil shishatokin. Like you have uncut stone. So here it's an uncut skin that was made into leather. Then you have, the leather has two, the leather, the parchment, whatever, has two layers. You can split those two layers apart, and when you do that, then you have two different pieces that you can use, two different layers that you can use for writing on. One is called klaf, one is called duchsus. The Tosfos and many other Rishonim explain that klaf is the outer layer, and duchsus is the inner layer. The duchsus, Tosfos explains here and in some other places, comes from two words. Duch means the place, and sustus is a word in Greek or in some other language meaning flesh. So duch sustus would be the place, the thing that comes from the place of the flesh. In other words, it's the layer of the skin that's closest to the flesh of the animal when it's alive. So that's klaf and duch sustus respectively. So now I'm going to throw a
sefer we have these days, it's written on two pieces, or one big piece, or double, or divided.
So what it is, so we're going to learn in the Gemara now that the original din was that Sefer Torah was supposed to be written on gvil, but nowadays they don't do that anymore. In particular, a Sefer Torah written on gvil would be extremely heavy because gvil is quite thick. So nowadays, what the Tosfos describes, that nowadays we don't do this exact process anyway. We do, the way we process our parchment nowadays is different in a number of particulars from the way they did it in the times of the Gemara. First of all, they don't actually split the skin into its two layers. What they do is they scrape away a little bit from the outside and a lot more from the inside. So therefore, Tosfos says that has the din of cloth. That in effect, it has the din of cloth. Because what they scrape off from the outside is only a little bit. Mostly what they scrape off is on the inside. And basically, therefore, they've scraped away the whole duchsus layer. And what you're left with is a cloth layer. Then
inside means the part touches the body of the animal?
Yes, the part that touches the flesh, the muscles of the animal, right. Right.
That's the part they scrape off the most.
So that's the part they scrape off the most nowadays, right. So okay. what they're left with is most of the outer layer, and therefore that's called cloth, so to say. Mind you have the Rambam in a Truva, actually, the Rambam, the Rambam in one of his Truvas, a couple of other Rishonim flip around the definitions, and they learn that cloth is the inner layer and duchsus is the outer layer. So according to them, it would mean that the Gemara is going to be discussing now the question of whether you can write Sefer Torah and Tefillin on duchsus. Then it would come out that our Sifrei Torah and our Tefillin are mostly no good because they're usually written on the kind of cloth that Tosfos describes. But most poskim have accepted the definition of Tosfos and the other Rishonim who agree with Tosfos that cloth is the outer layer. Anyway, Tosfos also mentions, by the way, when we talked about on Amud Aleph, when we talked about this matter of that you soak the parchment in gallnut extract in order to make it that now if you were to erase it, it would be noticeable, and therefore you're able to use it for a Sefer Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzah. Tosfos mentions we don't actually use that exact method of soaking it in gallnut extract. Nowadays we use something else. We use an extract from the bark of a tree or something, but Tosfos says it amounts to the same thing. The point is it still has the same effect. It still makes it that the parchment is white and clear, and that if you try to erase something on it, it'll be noticeable, and therefore it has the same din as the Efsa that was mentioned in the Gemara. Anyway, so the point is, getting back to the Gemara over here, so again, the Braisa is saying that klaf or duchsus, which we're assuming at this point means that you could write a mezuzah on either one, and the amount is, a person is chayiv only if it's large enough to write a mezuzah. Now mezuzah has Shema and Vahayim Shemaya. So what does our Mishnah mean when it says only if it's enough to write the Parsha of Shema? The answer is, my mezuzah Shabbat Tefillin. The answer is, when we use the word mezuzah, we mean it in a looser sense. We mean it, the mezuzah, we mean one of the parshiyos that's in Tefillin. We're nicknaming it mezuzah. The Gemara says, what do you mean? Rekori lo tefillin mezuzah? Since when do we find the parshiyos in Tefillin are called a mezuzah? The answer is, ain't. We do in fact find that. V'hotnan, and in fact, we find such a thing in a Braisa. By the way, it's interesting, almost everywhere in Shas, whenever we have a V'hot Tanya like that, which is a statement rather than a question, Rashi almost always says B'nichusa, because he wants us to be able to understand that it's an answer rather than a question. Here, for some reason, Rashi doesn't write that. I don't know why. Anyway, so V'hot Tanya, indeed we learn in a Braisa. Now, we learned in the first parak of our Masechta that the Chachamim made a Gzera, it's called the Gzeras of the Yurches Dover, that we said that if a person touches Kisvei HaKodesh with their bare hands, and their hands are Tomei as far as Truma and Kodshim, so the Braisa says, Ritzuit Tfilin Imat Tfilin, the straps of the Tfilin, when they're attached to the Tfilin, the Tamas of the Yadayim, then they're Matamei a person's hands if he touches them, but Bifnei Asman, but if the Ritzuit are not attached to the Tfilin, ain't Matamis to say dime, then they're not Matami the hands, because the Rasuas by themselves don't really have that level of Kusha. Reb Shimon ben Yehuda Oimer Mishum Reb Shimon. Reb Shimon ben Yehuda says the name of Reb Shimon. No, Hanegea Berasua Tahar. No, if a person touches the straps of the tefillin, his hands are still Tahar. Ad Shiyiga Bastissa. That's only a problem if he actually touches the bias of the tefillin. And Rav Zakkai Nishmoy Omer, Rav Zakkai says in the name of Rav Shimon, Tahar, that actually his hands are Tahar, Ad Sheyigav Mezuzah Asma, unless he touches the actual mezuzah, meaning the actual parchment that's inside the tefillin. So therefore, so we see that the parchment inside the tefillin is called a mezuzah. Maybe for the same reason, maybe because it's like a mezuzah, sort of, it's rolled up and put inside a case like a mezuzah is. Anyway, the point is, so yes, the Or Mishnah, when it uses the word mezuzah, could mean one of the parashiyos. So rather, when the Braisa uses the word mezuzah, it doesn't necessarily have to mean a mezuzah that you put on the doorpost, which contains two parashiyos, Shema and Vahayim Shemaya. It could mean the kind that goes into Tevilin, where you have the Shorosh. Each parasha is separate. The problem with that is the Halmi, the Katani Sefer Klach, Kedei Lichtevala Parasha Kanesha Tevilin, Shehi Shema Yisrael. The problem with that is that since the Braisa, we've quoted only the beginning of the Braisa before, we said Klach and Duchsus with the amount we carry, that's the right of the Zuzah, but then the Braisa continued that if a person carries Klach on Shabbos, then he's Chayab Kedei Lichtevala Parasha Kanesha Tevilin, Shehi Shema Yisrael. Then it says, like it says in the Mishnah, that he's Chayab if it's enough to be able to write a small Parasha and Tevilin, which is Shema Yisrael, Miklal, the Reisha, but Mezuzah, Asmaskinen. So evidently, then, we have two different cases. The Reisha is talking about something that you're going to use for an actual mezuzah that you're going to put up on the doorpost, and the second part is talking about tefillin. So therefore, so you have a stira within the Braisa itself. Although Tosfos says really the Gemara is not so much worried about the stira within the Braisa. The Gemara is more worried about the stira between the Braisa and our Mishnah, where our Mishnah just said flat out that you're chayev with parchment enough to write the parasha Shema Yisrael, and here the Braisa is saying that you're chayev for only if it's larger than that, only if it's enough to write Shema and Behoyim Shemaya. Okay. So my answer is no. Hochi Kotani. Actually, what the Braisa means is as follows. Klaf vid duchsus, whether we're talking about klaf or duchsus, shi'uran bakama, so we have to figure out with both of those things, both of those are writing materials. Each one is one half of the original skin, like we said before. Klaf is one layer and duchsus is the other. So what is the shear? And the Braisa gives us two different amounts. Duchsus kedei lichtevala mezuzah. If you're carrying duchsus, which is, again, according to Tosfos, the inner layer, the part that is closer to the muscles, then it would be kedei lichtevala mezuzah. Then it would be the amount to write a mezuzah. Because you can't write tefillin on duchsus, as the Gemara is going to start discussing now, as opposed to klaf. But if a person carries klaf on Shabbos, then it's a smaller amount, because you can write tefillin on klaf, then it's kedei lichtevala parashat kanesha b'tefillin shi shma Yisrael. Okay, so it's not, for the Braisa, it's not contradicting itself, because even though the Braisa began with the words klaf beduchsus, it didn't mean to imply that the two of them have the same shear. It meant we're going to talk in general about writing materials, klaf and duchsus, and each one has its own shear. One has a shear for tefillin, and one has a shear for mezuzah. Okay. So now the Gemara is going to discuss this point more, of what kinds of materials are you allowed to write the various things on, sifrei Torah, tefillin, and mezuzah. Omer Rab, duchsus harei k'klach. Rab says that duchsus has the din of klach, is like klach for certain din. And we have to figure out what that is. The Gemara starts with a statement. And the Gemara starts off that evidently Rav means by that, ma klach kos v'nol of tefillin, just like you're allowed to write tefillin on klach, ach duchsus kos v'nol of tefillin. It sounds like Rav is saying that you're allowed to write tefillin on duchsus as well. So let's see. Tanan, we learned in our Mishnah, klaf to the list of all the parashat kanesh of tefillin shishma Yisrael. We said in the Mishnah, only if a person carries klaf, then he's chayiv if he carries the amount that he could write the small parashah of Shema Yisrael, implying klaf ein duchsus esloi. It seems to imply that only if he carries klaf, then he's chayiv for that amount, but not duchsus. Duchsus would be, like we said in the Braisa before, would be the amount to write a whole mezuzah, which is both parashiyot. Tosfos actually doesn't like that gersa, because then the Gemara should have asked before when we were discussing that Braisa before, then the Gemara should have asked for this. So Tosfos just says that the question I'm Rav is really, since the Braisa before said a different amount, so we're not even being medayic from our Mishnah, we're just saying, because the previous Braisa explicitly said that there are different amounts for klaf and v'duchsus. Okay, the Gemara answers l'mitzvah. Okay, what we mean is the proper way, the ideal way to do the mitzvah is to write tefillin on klaf, but maybe Rav still means you are allowed to write them on duchsus, v'dyevin. So therefore, as the usual rule is, as we said before on that Ein Ches, that whenever you have two different uses for something, and one is much more common than the other, then the Chachamim establish the Shira based on the more common use. Since most people like to have their Shira be Mehudah and written properly, therefore most people are going to use Klaf, but even though technically you're allowed to use Duchsus, so far that's what the Gemara is saying, nevertheless, you're not going to say that the Shira, a piece of Duchsus, is where you can write one of the parashas that's coming on, because most people are not going to use Duchsus for that purpose. They're going to use klaf, which is the more preferable material. But still, we can still say that b'di'evin, you can use duchsus. Okay. The Gemara says, Toshma, halacha l'moshe mitzinai. The halacha l'moshe mitzinai is as follows. Tefillin ala klaf. Tefillin has to be written on klaf, the outer layer, according to Tosfos. Or mezuzah al duchfasus. Mezuzah has to be written on duchfasus. Where do you write on each one of them? Klaf b'mokim boso duchfasus b'mokim seir. On klaf, you write on the side closer to the flesh. And on duchfasus, you write on the side closer to the hair. Now, according to the Rambam Zirsa, his explanation that duchsus is the outer layer and klaf is the inner layer, then literally what the Braita is saying over here is defining what those are. Duchsus is the mokum seir. It's the side of the, it's the layer of the part of the skin that was closer to the, that had the hair of the animal on it when the animal was alive. And duchsister, that would be duchsister, rather. Klaf would be the part, the mokum boser, would be the part that is on, that's on the flesh side. So according to the Rambam, that's exactly what it would mean. That klaf, the Braita is partially defining where klaf and duchsister are. That duchsister is the outer layer and klaf is the inner layer. According to Tosfos, what it means is that the duchsus is the inner layer, klaf is the outer layer. On each one of them, you write on the side that when the animal was alive, was attached to the other layer. In other words, again, you peel the two layers apart. What you have is the place where those two layers were joined together is the place that you write on each one of the layers respectively. So on klaf, you're writing on the inner side of it, the side which when the animal was alive, touched the duchsus and was closer to the flesh than it is to the hair. And on duchsus, which was the inner layer, then you're writing on the outside of it, which was the side that was closer to the hair when the animal was alive. Anyway, the Braita continues. So again, the question is that the halacha of the Moshe Mishnah is tefillin can only be written on klaf. So what are you telling me that you can write them on duchsus? And then the answer is l'mitzvah. Okay, we mean the ideal mitzvah is to write them on klaf. The question is v'hatanya, but the Braita continues, the same Braita continues, Shina apostle, if he did differently than his apostle, so it sounds like it means if he wrote trillin on duchsus apostle, means who's a mezuzah. Okay, that part of the Braita is talking about a mezuzah. If you write a mezuzah on klaf, then it's apostle, but it doesn't mean that trillin apostle on duchsus. The problem with that is v'hatanya shina b'zeo b'zeo apostle. Another Braita says that if you change with this one or with this one, then it's possible. And it sounds like it means this one or this one, meaning tefillin or mezuzah. Either one, if you write on the wrong kind of, on the wrong layer, then it's possible. So therefore, so you see, just like you can't write a mezuzah on klaf, you also can't write tefillin on duchsus. The answer is idi v'idi on mezuzah. The answer is no. When it says bezeh or bezeh, it means both of them are referring to the mezuzah. But there's two things that you could end up doing wrong when you're writing a mezuzah. You could have that you write it on klaf, and then it's possible even if you wrote it on the right side of the klaf. And then you have that you wrote it on duchsus, which is the correct material, but you wrote it on the wrong side. You wrote it on the flesh side rather than the hair side. So therefore, the Braita will be talking about two different possibilities. One where you wrote it on the wrong material, and then it doesn't matter what side you wrote it on, or the other is you wrote it on the right material but the wrong side. There's still no proof that the Braita is telling you that tefillin would be possible on duchsus. The e boy same, or another possibility, you could say shina bazel bazef posel tanoi. You could say that shina bazel bazef tanoi. You could say this when the Braita says if you changed one or the other, then that would be actually a machlokas tanoi. So Rab is entitled to pick a side among tanoi. The Tanya, because we learn in a Braita shina bazel bazef, if you changed in this one or in that one, and here already we can understand bazel bazef meaning in tefillin or mezuzah. That it'd be possible. So if you wrote a mezuzah on klaf or tefillin on duchsus, either way it would be possible. But Rav Acha machshir, Rav Acha says that kosher, if tefillin are written on duchsus, he says it's kosher. Mishum Rav Achi b'chanina, he says that in the name of Acha b'chanina, v'amil mishum Rav Yaakov b'chanina, that tefillin would be kosher if they're written on duchsus. So there you go. So Rav could be going according to that. Okay. Rav Papa gives a different answer. Rav de Amma Katana Dvei Menashe. Rav is actually not following anything in the Braisa we just quoted, but rather a different Braisa from the Yeshiva of Menashe, the Tanit Vei Menashe. Kosva Ala Niyor, if you wrote it, and we're going to see soon what the it is, if you wrote it on paper or papyrus, as we discussed earlier, Ba'ala Maslis, or you wrote it on a piece of cloth, Psula, then it's possible, it has to be written on parchment, Ala Klaf Ba'ala Gvil Ba'al Duchsus Shera, but if you wrote it on Klaf or on Gvil or on Duchsus, so whether you have the outer layer, the two layers together, or the inner layer, either way it's kosher, so we have to ask, Kosva Mai. Okay, the Braisa just says, if you wrote it, but what's the it? What is it that the Braisa is saying? We'll be kosher with all three of them. E lema mezuzah. Are you going to say it's talking about a mezuzah? Can't be. Mezuzah on cloth mikas binon. Do we write a mezuzah on cloth? The pashtus, a mezuzah is always written on duchsus. Now, of course, nowadays we don't do that, but we're not done the discussion in the Gemara yet. So we still have to figure it out. But so far, the Gemara is assuming a mezuzah is always written on duchsus and nothing else. But obviously the Braisa cannot be talking about a mezuzah, because a mezuzah would be possible if it was written on cloth. El alav v'tfilin. Evidently the Braisa has to be talking about tfilin. So therefore you see, so when Rav says that duchsus is like cloth, that's what he's talking about. He's going according to Tanit Vei Menashe and saying that tfilin are kosher if they're written on duchsus. The problem with that is, according to your svara, if you're going to say the Braisa is talking about tefillin, what do you mean? Are you allowed to write tefillin on grill? You can't write tefillin on grill. You're telling me that you would actually be able to write tefillin on them, that the halacha l'mishmitina is machachila, you should write them on cloth, but the yebed, you can write them on anything. But the Gemara is saying that no. We said that maybe you could write tefillin on duchsus. Nobody said so far that you could write tefillin on grill, on the unsplit parchment. So obviously the Braisa cannot be talking about tefillin either. Ela kitanyahi the Sefer Torah. So evidently you have to say that Braisa is talking about a Sefer Torah. So a Sefer Torah would come out so far is kosher to write on any of the three, grill or cloth or duchsus. Okay. Now that's not the halacha actually. The Rambam in fact paskins and it's brought in Shulchan Aruch that you're not allowed to write a Sefer Torah on duchsus because there are gemaras in other places. There are gemaras in other places that say that you can't write a Sefer Torah on duchsus. But at least in terms of our braisa over here, we could say that it's talking about a Sefer Torah that Tanit Vei Menashe at least would say that it's kosher on any one of them. Okay, the gemara says lema mesayle. In that case, can we say that the following braisa supports what Rav is saying? The first part of the Braisa talks about the idea of ein meridin mekdusha chamura lekdusha kala. You're not allowed to take something that had a higher level of kedusha and downgrade it to a lower level of kedusha. For example, the Braisa starts by saying you can't take a tefillin shel rosh and make it into a tefillin shel yad, because a tefillin shel rosh has a higher kedusha because it has the shins on it. It has the shins on it. It has the dalid and the resuas. Continues the Braisa, similarly, tefillin shabola with Sefer Torah shabola. Suppose that tefillin or a Sefer Torah wear out, and you can't use them as tefillin, and you can't use them as a Sefer Torah before, anymore. Ein osin mehen mezuzah. The din is you're not allowed to take a section from it and cut it out and use it as a mezuzah. Because again, you're not allowed to take it from a higher level of kedusha to a lesser level of kedusha. The mezuzah has a lesser level of kedusha because the Sefer Torah has the entire Torah in it. The tefillin has four parshiyos, and the mezuzah only has two parshiyos. So you're not allowed to. Now, by the way, you have a machlokes for shonim whether in the case of a mezuzah you would be allowed to sew together two pieces of parchment to make a mezuzah. So Rashi and Tosfos learned that actually you would be allowed to. So therefore, we're talking about, let's say, so you would take the parasha of Shema from your tefillin that wore out. You'd take the parasha of Vahoyim Shemaya, sew them together, and there you go. You have what you need for a mezuzah. The Rambam learns that not. The Rambam learns that, and this is brought by halacha, you're not allowed to. A mezuzah has to be written on one solid piece of parchment. So therefore, Tosfos explains, according to that, that what we'd be talking about, let's say, for example, it happened in a Sefer Torah that the parasha of Shema was written at the bottom of a column. And then let's say you have a blank space underneath it, because you always have a margin of a few esbois wide at the bottom of a Sefer Torah. So let's say, therefore, what would you do? You'd cut out that parasha of Shema from the worn out Sefer Torah. You'd write Vahoyim Shemaya underneath it, and you have yourself a mezuzah. So the mission of the Braisa is saying you can't do that because you can't bring it down from Kedusha Chamura to Kedusha Kala. The point is, Taima, why are we saying you can't? The Ein Meridin is only because you can't bring it down to a lower level of Kedusha. Hol Meridin Oisin, implying if it weren't for that problem, you would be allowed to do it. Now we have to ask the Chesiva Amai. What were these tefillin written on that we're talking, what were these tefillin written on that hypothetically you might try to use for a mezuzah? Lav dechtiva justices. The pashtus, we're talking about they were written on justices because we just said before that you can't write a mezuzah on cloth. So therefore, necessarily, we have to be talking about tefillin that were written on justices. And now you're trying to take a parasha from the tefillin and use it for a mezuzah. And you're saying you can't, not because it's not the right material, but because we can't bring it down to kedusha kala. So therefore, we see, you see what Rab is saying, that you can write tefillin on justice. The answer is nice, not necessarily the tefillin on cloth. No, because you could say that the tefillin we're talking about are written on cloth. Problem again is, a mezuzah cloth mikas minun. Since when can you write a mezuzah on cloth? Didn't we say before mezuzah dafka has to be written on justice? The answer is ain. Yes, as a matter of fact, you can write a mezuzah on cloth. V'ha tanya. And indeed, we learn a braisa to that effect. If you write a mezuzah on cloth or on paper or on a cloth, then it's possible. But Amar Rav Shimon Elazar, Rav Shimon Elazar says no, on cloth it's actually kosher. Rav Meir hoya kos v'ala cloth. Rav Meir used to write mezuzahs on cloth, because it stays better, it preserves better, because when it's written on cloth is stronger than duchtus. So therefore, a mezuzah written on cloth will last longer. The Meiri gives a different reason. He says cloth is thinner, so therefore you're more easily able to roll it up and then put it into the mezuzah case without the letters cracking off or whatever. Anyway, point is,
Everybody agree that writing it on duchtesus is a downgrading in kedusha?
No, we're not saying no. We're not saying that writing it on duchtesus. We're saying that take a piece of tefillin, to take a parasha of tefillin, or to take a piece that's cut out from the Sefer Torah and use it to make a mezuzah would be downgrading the kedusha. We're not saying writing it on duchtesus is downgrading. What we're saying is tefillin. We're discussing the question whether tefillin can be written on duchtesus. We're saying a Sefer Torah for sure cannot be, but tefillin, we're discussing back and forth the question whether you're allowed to write them on duchtesus. But now the question is, suppose you had tefillin written on cloth, let's say, are you allowed to take a parasha from those tefillin and make it into a mezuzah? And the answer is no, because you're bringing it down to kedusha kala, because a mezuzah has less kedusha than tefillin. Anyway, the point is, we see from this last braisa that we quoted that you can, in fact, write a mezuzah on cloth, and Rav Meir used to do that. So there you go, then. So we could say that the braisa that we quoted before implies that you're allowed to write tefillin on cloth. So suppose you have a tefillin that was written on cloth, and now you have, and now the tefillin are worn out, and you want to repurpose a parasha of the tefillin for a mezuzah, then you can't do that because kedusha chamura and kedusha kala. So therefore, so that braisa doesn't prove anything about whether you're allowed to write tefillin on justices. Maybe it's talking about tefillin that were written on cloth, and in fact, the mezuzah can be written on cloth also. But the Gemara says, you're right. Hashtag the office law. Now that you arrived at that answer, then we should correct what we quoted before from Rav, not that duchtesus is like cloth in the sense that just like you can write tefillin on cloth, so you can write them on duchtesus. Ella Eimer, rather flip it around and say the other way around. Cloth hareu kaduchtesus. Cloth has the din like duchtesus, meaning ma duchtesus, toastman, all of mezuzah, just like you're definitely allowed to write a mezuzah on duchtesus, and that for sure, because we said before, Allah Moshe Mishinai, is to do that. Af cloth, toastman, all of mezuzah, the same thing, cloth, you're also allowed to write a mezuzah on. So that's the bottom line. The actual bottom line halacha is that tefillin can be written, on cloth, and we don't have a proof whether you can write it on justices. The halacha is that, in fact, you can't. You can't write them on drill either. So tefillin can only be written on cloth. A mezuzah could be written on cloth or justices. A sefer Torah could be written on any of them. Lemaisa, nowadays, all of them are written on cloth. Nobody writes on grill or on duchtesus anymore, especially because you have the different opinions what cloth and duchtesus are. But anyway, nowadays, all three of them are written on cloth, and all three of them are kosher in that way.
It's interesting that You could write a Sefer Torah on Klafo Dulcisus when we assume that the Sefer Torah is a greater Kedusha than Kedusha.
That's true, but again, but Dulcisus is not that it has lesser Kedusha. It's just Halacha L'Moshe Mishinei was the proper way to do it. Halacha L'Moshe Mishinei is the proper way to do it. It's to write a Sefer Torah on Zil, fill it on Klaf, and Mizuz on Dulcisus. But L'Maisa, based on this Gemara and based on other Gemaras that are relevant to this in particular, in Masechet Menachos, it comes out, it is actually kosher to write a Sefer Torah on Klaf as well. And maybe on Dulcisus as well. Tefillin can be written only on Klaf. It's the Maskana over here, because we're saying we don't have any proof that you can write it on Dulcisus. And a Mezuzah can be written on Klaf or Dulcisus. So because it comes out, based on other relevant Gemaras as well, that all three of them can be written on Klaf. So the Minhag developed over time among Sofrim that all of that, that's what's done. All three of them nowadays are written on Klaf. Nobody ever writes on Gril or Dulcisus anymore.
Even though it's Halacha Moshe Mishina that a Sefer Torah has to be written on the, can be written rather on
Gril. Yes. So
on Gril.
What it is the Poskim explained, beginning from the Rambam explained, that when we say a Sefer Torah is written on Gril, it means L'mitzvah. It means the ideal way of doing it is to write a Sefer Torah on Gril. But it is kosher on Klaf. All it means is that when it says Gvil, it means you can't use Duchsus for a Sefer Torah, but you could use Klaf. And the same thing when it comes to a Mezuzah that Amam learns, when it says that a Mezuzah is ideally written on Duchsus, it means as opposed to you cannot write a Mezuzah on Gvil, but you could write it on Duchsus or you could write it on Klaf. And
it's the ideal way to write a Sefer Torah on Gvil. Why do we write it on Klaf? And the same question with Mezuzah.
Again, because it's hard, it's not so easy, especially nowadays, where they make the parchment differently than they did in the times of the Gemara. I mean, they don't split it into the two layers. They actually scrape away, so you don't really have any justice to work with at all. And as far as Gvil, they don't make parchment that way anymore. They don't make parchment as Gvil. And in fact, practically speaking, again, a Sefer Torah written on Gvil would be extremely heavy and not really practical. And then it would be very hard. It would be a bit hard to use practically.
So the old Sefer Torah that we have, the very old ones that go back a few hundred years, you know, from the medieval times, are they written on Gvil or written on Klaf?
Some of them maybe are written on Gvil. I don't know. I don't know, actually. I don't know. I mean, we don't really have a lot of old Sefer Torah nowadays.
It's very heavy that it's written in Gvil.
Exactly. I think there may be some old ones that are.
That's not what I'm asking. Yeah. That's not what I'm asking. I know if it's written on Gvil, it's heavy, but I'm asking is, what was it written on? What are the old Sefer Torah written on?
I don't know. I don't know, actually. Mm-hmm. It could be. It could very well be they're written on Gvil. I don't know. All right.
Okay.
Rabbi. Okay, I'm going to get a